Lord, thank you that worship begins and ends at you. That you are the one worthy of our worship. And Lord, as we continue our journey through worship this morning, we thank you for the blessing that the music has been. We ask that your word would continue to minister to us, that our hearts and minds would be open to hearing from you now. We ask you to be here with us. Amen. If you take a good look, you can see it all around you. You might not recognize it at first. You might not be able to really see it for what it is, but it's there. It is. Let's look at it this way. Think about the shrill in a teenage girl's voice when her heartthrob walks on stage. Or the way in which we throw our hands up for the next pop diva. Or the way crowds of thousands upon 10,000s and sometimes hundreds of thousands will gather for the latest British sensation. It's around us. It's there. You see it. You might not recognize it, but it's there. But see, Justin's not any bigger than Michael ever was. Taylor isn't any bigger than Madonna was back in the day. Harry, Louis, Liam, Niall, and Zayn, they're just the latest British import since those boys named Paul, John, Ringo, and George. It's there. You see it. But maybe music's not your thing. Maybe you're one of these guys that considers yourself a jock, or ladies that considers sports your thing. Have you ever heard of a rabid fan base or a rabid fan? Tens of thousands, maybe somewhere between 80 and 100,000 people gathered in a stadium on the edge as it comes down to the last play. Will they or won't they win? Yelling at refs for making bad calls, cursing at the other team, losing their minds in anticipation. Tears come with both victory and defeat. Or think about this whole profession that's come up around stalking people. We call them paparazzi. We have people that their job is to tell us what certain people in our world eat, where what they breathe, where they sleep, who they sleep with, what they wear, where they go, what they drive. Maybe almost like we want to find our own Greek gods and goddesses. We want to know everything about their lives. We want to know every single detail. And so we pay people to let us know every moment of their lives. It's there. You might not recognize it, but it's there. Even think about the magnetic preacher. He has such a soothing voice. He is so humble. He is so holy. And think about his adoring flock. It can be there too. Or maybe just an esteemed professor, somebody who's changed our world because of her mind, because of her research and her sacrifice. So wise, so understanding, and so knowledgeable, you can't wait for every word that comes in her class, in her books. The ground that she walks on is hallowed ground. Maybe we bring it back home and it's a beloved coach. He's done so much for our kids. He's helped them get out of trouble. He's put them together, made them a team. They've had so much success. He has done it right. Maybe it's somebody off in the distance, the man who has the fortune that seems untouchable. He has everything you could ever want, the cars and the homes and the boats and the planes. If only I could have that. If only I could find out the secret to his success. It's there. Sometimes it becomes really personal when we think that sometimes it's there too in the eyes of the significant other, as you want to lose yourself in their gaze. It can be there too. We think about the 15-year-old, 16-year-old, 17-year-old young men and young women as they lose their minds over one another. Teenage, young love. It can be there too. And the list could go on and on and on. It's there. Worship is all around us. We were created for worship. Maybe you're a little uncomfortable with me now, but I just called all those things worship. I hope you're uncomfortable with me calling some of those things worship. Because I think when we think about our teen dreams, the rock bands, the sports teams, the captivating preachers, the global entrepreneurs, the wise beyond their years professors, our significant others, I think we know when they start to get our worship, something is a little off. It just doesn't seem right. But isn't it what it is? We know maybe that's not the right thing to call it, but it's there. And so I think in some ways we know that the images that we get when we think about this group of young people gathered together to worship, the musicians, or we think about all these burly men in a stadium together to worship their team, we see something in that passion, in that excitement, in the ability to lose oneself in it that is compelling. We see something about that life, we say, there's something there. And I think that's one of the reasons why we lament when we see lives of sedation. When we walk through the casino and we see people staring lifelessly at a slot machine, pulling the handle, hoping something good comes. When you walk through your living room and you see your kids there with these buttons, something seems to be missing. When you find people that have given hours and days and years of their lives to television programs, to movies, when we just sort of see that we sort of turned everything off, and we're lifeless and sedated, we know that something's missing there. And so then we look back at the crowds and the frenzies. We say, there's something there. We're meant for more than this life of sedation. We're meant to express ourselves. We're meant to cheer for something. We're meant to worship. But here's the problem. These things that we often find ourselves worshiping, they don't hold up. People can't handle our worship. Let me say it this way. We were created for worship. We were not created to be worshiped. Yes, I want fame. Yes, I want fans. Yes, I want acclaim. Yes, we might want to be known, to be famous, all these things. But people were not created to be worshiped. We can't handle it. That's why we get the scandals. That's why we get the rehab reports. That's why we get the arrests when these people that we start worshiping, when they start to lose it, because they can't handle it. They weren't meant for our worship. That's why as soon as the acclaimed pastor gets put on a pedestal where he is holy in and of himself, his word is Bible truth, it's when he's headed for destruction because he can't handle the pressure. He can't handle being God for people. That's why as soon as the tycoon gets to the point where he thinks he has such a fortune that he's untouchable, that the rules don't apply to him anymore, that's exactly when he's just about to lose it all. That's why we aren't supposed to be worshipped, because we can't handle it. We were created for worship, but we weren't created to be worshipped. So move beyond the people. The music, it stirs in our souls. It changes the way we see the world. It does something in us. But the music fades. The lyrics change. The rhythms change. Champions are on top of the world for a time. And then the next tournament comes, or the next season comes, and champions are replaced. Teams, musicians, people are not meant to be worshipped. The only one capable of taking all of our praise is the living God. He's the only one worthy of our worship. We were created to praise Him, to give Him honor, to give Him glory. We were created to worship. I hope some of you are sitting there saying, but wait, I was created to work. I love my work. I'm good at it. Or some of you say, I was created for love. I was created for purpose. I was created for joy. You can give me anything you want, and yes, and yes, and yes, you were created for work, and you were created for love, and you were created for purpose, and you were created for joy. But it all falls under our worship. Through our worship, we tell God how much we love Him. Through our work, when we do it well, we can worship God. We can worship God through our joy. Our worship gives everything we do purpose. You were created to do work, but you were created for worship. And in order to sort of show you that, let's go all the way back to the beginning. Go back to the garden. If you don't know the story, God created everything at the beginning. The animals and the fish, the birds, the wild beasts, the seas and the heavens, the stars and the sun and the moon. He created the land and the sea. And He created the people. And it was good. It was really, really good. And He gave us a job. He gave us the task of ruling over the kingdom that He had created. We were in a relationship where we were walking with God. He was with us. We had work, but we were dependent on God. He was our provider. He was the one who gave us what we needed. He had a relationship with us. It was a good relationship. And then in the first act of idolatry in history, we decided that maybe we could figure it out on our own. We decided that we wanted to be like God. And so we sinned. Took a fruit that was forbidden to us. The fruit that was there not to tease us or antagonize us, but the fruit that was there to remind us that it was God's garden, that it was His and He had given it to us. And we said, well, what if we take charge? What if we do it our way? And so we put ourselves before God. We put what we wanted before what He wanted. And we messed it up because we forgot the act of submission to God, the act of worship to God. So home changed for us. The garden wasn't a place where we walked with God anymore. We had removed ourselves from that. So our relationships changed. Instead of seeking God, we started seeking after one another. And our work changed. Rather than being a joy and a delight and a privilege to lead and rule in God's kingdom, our work became toilsome. And again, it wasn't just because God was being mean to us. It was because we had screwed it up, and he needed to remind us that this is his world. And the only way we remember that is when we remember that we're dust, and from dust we return. So our work became hard. And you see, it's easy to forget that we're created to worship when we're faced with temptations on our own, like Adam and Eve were. One of the reasons we gather together as churches across the world is to remind each other that we're supposed to worship. We're created to worship. And just like in the garden, we had an intimate relationship with God, where he was our provider. He was the one that gave us everything we need. We depended on him, and we walked with him. You go to the end of the Bible, and we're back there in a place where, again, he's providing for everything we need. We're dependent on him, and we get to spend all of our days worshiping him. But we only get there through Christ, only through his sacrifice, only through God coming to rescue us by putting on flesh, living a sinless life, showing us how we're actually supposed to live as a life of worship, and then dying in our place for our sins. He is the bridge between the garden at the beginning and the garden at the end. He is the one that shows us the life that you were created for, the one you were meant to live and worship, you now get only through me. He is that bridge that gets us from the garden back to the garden. It's Christ who brings us back into a life of worship. This spring, I got to spend some time teaching the junior hires on worship. And we broke the word down like this. The English word worship comes from this idea of worth and this word ship, but not like a boat. The same ship that attaches to friendship or sportsmanship. The word that means something like having a quality of. So we talk about friendship. It's a friend, and you're having the quality of being a friend. Or sportsmanship, it's a sportsman having the quality of being a sportsman. So the idea of worship is worth and having the quality of. Our worship is ascribing to the one who has the quality of being worthy. So when we talk about worship, all we're doing is recognizing the only one that has the quality of being worth our worship. As you look through the Old Testament and the New Testament, and you look at the different words for praise and worship and glory and giving God these things, there's sort of two images that we get from the Old Testament and the New Testament words for these. One is this intentional verbal declaration of the right kind of praise, meaning I go out of my way to say the right kind of things about somebody when I'm worshiping. So when we talk about the Old Testament and the New Testament images of worship, one of the images we get is this proclamation of the right kind of praise for the one we're worshiping. And then the second image is the posture that I talked about with the kids. Is the posture that gets on your knees and realizes that I am not the one that's worth the worship. It's the posture that says, I am dependent. I am vulnerable. I need. And it is the one that proclaims to God that he is worthy of our worship. So the Old Testament and New Testament concepts have to do with verbal proclamation, but then also taking a posture of humility, of kneeling, bowing down to the one who is worthy of worship. And this acronym I put together behind me, it's an incomplete list. I'm not trying to encapsulate everything about worship with that list of concepts back there, but I wanted to give us some tangible, just sort of reminders about maybe what worship is supposed to look like for us. The first is, when we think about worship, it's supposed to be wholehearted. It's not supposed to be half-hearted worship. when we walk into worship and we say, I wish I was in bed right now. Oh. Jesus, you're good. That's kind of like if I were to walk up to my wife at one point in time and say, you know, you're okay. You're pretty. You want to go out? Maybe that's how I did it. I don't know. I don't remember. We've made it sort of cool to pretend to not care about stuff, to be half-hearted about stuff. Because when we are wholehearted in worship, in our work, at home, when we're wholehearted about anything, you know what that says? It says to the world, it puts us on display and says, that's who that person is. They're showing you everything they got. And it makes us so vulnerable, we don't want to do it. We're actually scared to be wholehearted about anything. Because when we're wholehearted about something, people see us for who we are, for what we value. But our worship is supposed to be wholehearted. We don't just want a casual, lazy, laid-back, it doesn't really matter. It's not the right kind of worship. More than that, worship is about bringing an offering to God. But it's more than just money. Whenever we talk about offerings, you always think I'm trying to hit you up for money, or Jim's trying to hit you up for money. Really, what the offering is, it's about a whole life sacrifice. In your study guide, you'll notice this quote from A.W. Tozer. No man gives anything acceptable to God until he has first given himself in love and sacrifice. Our first offering to God is ourselves, our hearts, our minds, our souls, our lives. You can have everything. When we give our money back to God, it's really just a symbol of the fact that we understand that it all comes from God. It all goes back to God. It is all His anyway. We can give a whole lot of things as an offering, but it starts with our lives. Then we can give our work, we can give our families, we can give our homes, we can give all these things as offerings to God. But worship asks us to offer ourselves to God. The passage from Exodus this morning, where we get the first commandment, we're supposed to worship God and have no other idols before us. It reminds us that we're supposed to have reverence for God. We don't approach God casually. He is the Almighty. He is the sustainer of life and death. He is the one who gave us all of it. We can't stand in His presence. He's to be revered. He's the one that saved us. No one else can do it. So we revere Him. In worship, one of the things that I think is hardest about living a life of worship and being in worship for people is the fact that it requires submission from us. It's really hard to show up to worship or to live a life of worship where you say, hey, you're awesome and I'm going to do my own thing. A life of worship is a life that is surrendered and submitted to the will of God. Jesus reminds us this when He's encountering Satan while He's wandering in the wilderness. Satan tries to get Him to bow down and He says, you will bow down to no one other than the living God. The idea of our worship, we're giving honor to God. We're giving Him His due credit. We're proclaiming His goodness. We're reminded that He is the one that's worthy of our praise. In our worship, it's really hard to live a life of worship casually or by happenstance. We have to be intentional in the way that we live out our worship. Joshua writes in verse 24 of his book, he says, you choose who you'll serve, whether you serve the foreign gods, the foreign idols. But as for me and my household, we're going to choose to worship, to serve the living God. There's a choice involved in worship. We have to be intentional in our worship. And our worship is about praise. We're reminded by Peter in 1 Peter 2:9 that we have been called out to give God praise. He has called us out, rescued us, redeemed us to give him praise. It's just an acronym. It's not the whole picture. But I wanted you to have some reminders this morning of what worship is supposed to look like. That it's supposed to be wholehearted, that we're supposed to offer ourselves. We're supposed to revere God in worship, that we're supposed to submit our lives to God in worship, that we're supposed to honor him, that we need to be intentional about it, and that we need to proclaim his praises. And going from here, I can't think of really a much better application. Just say, be part of a group that worships. We forget so easily that we're created for worship. And we forget so easily on our own who it is we're supposed to worship. We get distracted. We find the latest video game. We find some new music. The Cardinals might actually be good this year. We forget so easily who it is that we're supposed to worship. So the reason that we get together as a church, Desert Hope, the reason we gather together, our strategy behind gathering together is to remind one another that we're created for worship, that we want to do this together. It's too hard to do on our own. We don't get together just because the cookies are awesome. We don't get together just because you like looking at me. We get together to remind each other that we're created for worship. Joshua said, as for me and my household, we're going to serve the Lord. What about your home? What about your family? Has your family ever made the choice that says, this family, this home, this household, as for us, we'll worship that God. That's a choice for our family. We'll do that together. We'll figure out how to worship God as a family. How about in your marriage? I think sometimes, especially for new couples that are so enamored and in love with each other, sometimes it feels like I could almost worship that person. And we put some of our dependence and our need and worship on our spouse. You're not meant to worship your spouse. You're meant to worship with them. How do you worship in your marriage? How do you worship together in your marriage? At your work, whether you hate your job or whether you love your job and you think you're doing exactly what you're supposed to be doing in the world, how do you worship in your work? I think one of the biggest, I don't know what else to call it, but one of the biggest potential pitfalls we place in front of college students these days is telling them to go find something that they love to do. And here's why I say that. It's not bad to find what you love to do, but it is very, very rare that somebody actually finds work in this world that they absolutely love to do. There are billions more people in this world doing a job they're not real fond of than there are people that can say, I love to do it. If you find something you love to do, you are blessed and you are lucky. But in spite of a job that you may or may not like, and when we tell kids that are 18 years old, find something you love to do, and then they're 45 and still living at home, and they say, well, I haven't found what I love to do, you wonder why they're still at home. They're searching for this thing that's hard to find. In your work, how do you find a way to worship God in spite of maybe what might be an easy job or not? At school, young people, I see a lot of you today. I don't think there's anything more compelling to your peers at school than to encounter other young people that have figured out the art and beauty of worship. Kids that have figured out, you know what, I realize that kid's going to pick on me today and it's going to suck, but I'm created to worship and it's going to be okay. You know what, I might get a B on a test, it's going to be okay because I am created to worship. I think the most compelling life that you can find in our schools are the kids that have figured out that they're created to worship. It changes everything for us. in our friendships. A lot of times, one of the things we don't ever want to do with our friends is bring up the concept of worshiping God, because, again, it makes us vulnerable. How do you worship with your friends? Thank you for dragging some of your friends to church today to worship with us. How about your vacations? No, we don't worship on vacation. That's for us. I have friends that choose to take their vacation time to go serve others overseas. What if you took a family mission trip as a way to worship? I think it's an awesome idea. How about with your money? If you give a little bit of your money, give a little bit more of your money. How do you worship with your money? What does it say about who you believe is in control? We're created for worship. I had asked Steph to bring Evan Lee out. But is it going to work? You want to see me? She likes hanging out in the nursery. We're created for worship. By the way, we're expecting again. I know when I chose to do this, I'm probably not going to be able to hold it together. I'll do my best. Avonlea was created for worship. Her little sister or brother is created for worship. I have hopes and dreams and prayers for her. But at the end of the day, my greatest desire for her is that she would come to love and know God and to worship Him with her life. At the end of the day, that's what I want for her life and for her little sibling. That's what I want for my kids. I know you guys are... I think one tear is going to come out. Awesome. I know you guys feel the same. And some of you might say, well, yeah, you're the pastor. Duh, you want the kid to do what you say. You want them to worship. I say this as a pastor. I say this as a father. I don't think we can live a more compelling life than the life of worship. Yes, I want my daughter to worship. Yes, it's my job. Yes, there's that. I want your kids. The only thing I want for the students that I work with is for them to live a life of worship. That's what I want for them. I'll do my best to get them there with your help, with God's help. The most compelling life that we can live is a life of worship. And we gather together. We keep coming back. It's our strategy, Desert Hope, to keep doing this together. Not because we've got it all put together. Not because I need a paycheck. We do this, we come together because we need to remind one another that we're supposed to live a life of worship. Our strategy is to meet together, to worship together, to continue to remind each other. This is why we were made. This is why Christ sacrificed for us so we can worship. This is the last thing I'm going to say. As we try to plan for the future, and as we think about who we are as a church and who we want to be as a church, I don't think there is anything more compelling in the world about a church than a church that has figured out how to worship together in spirit and in truth. I don't think it's about the church with the latest gimmicks or the newest technology. I think there are millions of people, I think there are thousands of people in our neighborhoods that go to stadiums, that turn on the TV, that go to concerts, that sit in class, that listen to certain preachers on the television, looking for what it is they're supposed to worship, because we know we were created for worship. We are surrounded by people that, whether or not they realize it, they were created for worship, and they're looking for that place, that thing that they're supposed to worship. None of the people, none of the teams, none of the music is going to hold up. the living God will. He is worthy of our worship. It all goes back to him. And I think the most compelling thing we can do as a church is learn how to worship together in spirit and in truth, because it's what we were created for. And in the end, we were created so all the glory would go back to God. Amen.